Hello, you're listening to Shoes on a Wire on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Madeline Taylor, and I am broadcasting to you right now from the unceded territories of the Hunkamedum-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Shoes on a Wire is a brand new show hosted by me, and this is episode 2. Later this show, I have an interview with Carmen Aguirre, an author and theater artist whose most recent book, Mexican Hooker No. 1, has been out for close to a year at this point. It is a memoir about her journey through theater school as a woman of color. The memoir also deals with her experience confronting and recovering from a brutal experience of childhood rape. We do not go into graphic detail about the rape in our interview, but some listeners may find the topic triggering, and this will not be suitable for children. Yesterday, I read a headline on dsmog.ca about how the BC Ministry of Environment had granted a mining corporation permission to drain mining waste into Lake Quesnel. I have an aunt who lives in Quesnel. Her name's Anna, and she's incredibly eccentric. Whenever I go to see her, she drinks a little too much red wine and starts to sing a song called Paddlin' Madeline Home. Her house is stacked with knickknacks and handicrafts. It is dusty and colorful. She's the kind of woman who buys onions in those 50-pound orange sacks and then deconstructs the sack in order to use the thread to crochet pot scrubbers. To be honest, we've never gotten along. But I wonder about how her life will change when the inevitable environmental effects of this mind-draining waste into the lake become evident. I can only guess there will be more danger to swimming in the lake than the duck itch I was warned about as a kid. Lake water might be toxic rather than silt-flavored. Just something to think about. Here's Vancouver artist Hazy with Drink You, Brooklyn.
It's true, it's great, it's blue. Tired of the gender binary, gender policing, or just want to speak your truth?
Join CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective.
This group of radio makers is all about centering the voices, issues, concerns, and experiences of women identified, transgender, intersex, two-spirit, genderqueer, gender non-conforming, non-binary, and gender fluid folks and allies.
Anyone can join, no experience necessary.
Like the Gender Empowerment Collective on Facebook or email volunteer at citr.ca.
Our show, Babe Waves, airs Thursdays from 5 to 6 and features music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
What's even better than Record Store Day? What about a day after Record Store Day party? The day after Record Store Day in the daytime, and you can bring a date or make it a day by hanging out from 2 to 7 p.m. CITR Radio 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine are teaming up with CJSF 90.1 FM for the first ever Record Store Day after party on April 23rd. A one-stop shop all-day record fair with local vendors and performances by Co-op, Jerk Jail, Sad Photography, Elisa Thorne, and Pale Red. One update, the party has moved to the Astoria at 769 East Hastings. Unfortunately, it's no longer an all-ages party, but you can tune in to listen to the live broadcast from 3 to 6 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM or CJSF 90.1 FM all day. Save the date. Make it a day.
That was Hazy with Drink You Brooklyn. Once again, you're listening to Shoes on a Wire on CITR 101.9 FM, and I'm Madeline Taylor. This is a content warning. Coming up in the next half hour is an interview with Carmen Aguirre, author and theater artist, and we discuss issues of rape, trauma, and state violence. This interview is not appropriate for children, and some listeners may find it triggering.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
For many of us, extreme trauma is not the kind of thing we discuss publicly. For better or for worse, our struggles remain silent, private, and unseen. This is not so for Carmen Aguirre. Carmen Aguirre is an author, actor, and playwright born in Santiago, Chile. By the age of 6, Carmen and her family had been accepted into Canada as political refugees. Carmen's parents were intellectuals and activists, and they were forced to flee Chile after Augusto Pinochet's military coup in 1973. In her adolescence, Carmen lived between South America and Vancouver. She lived in communities of revolutionaries, activists, and members of the Chilean resistance movement. She was inspired to join the resistance as well and went back to South America until the late 1980s to participate as a resistance fighter. At this point, she returned to Vancouver to pursue acting at Studio 58. In 2011, Aguirre published Something Fierce, Memoirs of a Revolutionary Daughter. This book chronicled her childhood and experiences in the Chilean resistance movement. She reflected on the impact of state terrorism, fear, and determination. The book achieved national acclaim, but there was a story she had left out. At the age of 12, Carmen and her cousin were brutally raped by the paper bag rapist while living in Vancouver. This man hunted and assaulted dozens of children in the Lower Mainland throughout the 1980s. In her newest memoir, Mexican Hooker No. 1 and Other Roles Since the Revolution, Carmen writes about healing from trauma and finding an outlet through the arts. We spoke in August of 2016. We talked about why she turned to storytelling, how sharing the story of being raped has felt, and the experience of living life in exile. This is Carmen Aguirre.
My name is Carmen Aguirre, and I'm a theater artist and author. So I'm from Chile, and Chilean mainstream culture, as well as, of course, all the indigenous cultures in Chile, are storytelling cultures. Your elders tell you stories about where you came from, and for me, it was just part of life that you would, you know, as a child, I would sit around and listen to my elders tell stories. When I started to go to Studio 58 26 years ago already, I was one of only three people of color in the entire student body. And of course, the faculty was 100% white. And I was told almost immediately by my mentors that it would be very difficult for me to find work when I graduated because I'm a woman of color, and that I would probably only get cast as hookers and maids. And they were absolutely right. So it was at that time that I started to realize that I needed to tell my own stories in order to create work for myself. And Studio 58 was very supportive of me in doing that. I also started to realize that with it came a very big responsibility to my community, right, to the Latino community in exile.
At what point did you know you were an actor?
Oh, when I was three. We were living in Chile, and my parents took me to the circus in Patagonia, which is in the south of Chile, and it was packed, like everybody in town had gone to the circus. But there was a moment in which a woman in a bikini was balancing on a white horse that was running in circles, galloping in circles around the ring. And what I remember about it is that it was a mix. It caused a mix of emotions in me, that image, which is that I was terrified that something would happen to her, right, that she would fall and kill herself. But it was also exciting. There was something also very kind of taboo about it because it was sexual, right? Like she was in a bikini, and something kind of like underground about it too. Yeah, I think it was kind of like a bit of a sleazy kind of circus, actually. That's etched in my memory, and it was at that moment that I knew I wanted to be a performer.
So your first memoir, Something Fierce, Memoirs of a Revolutionary Daughter, came out in 2011 and focuses on your childhood and experiences in the Chilean Resistance. And Mexican Hooker Number One and My Other Roles Since the Revolution was published this year and focuses on your life as an actor and coming to deal with the trauma of being raped as a child by the paper bag rapist. So what has changed since 2011 in the space between memoirs while you're working on the second one that allowed you to tell the story of recovery and trauma from the rape?
It's not that much has changed. It's just that the theme of the first memoir was living in a state of terror due to state terrorism, right? And so there were two themes. There was that one, and then there was a theme of personal desire clashing with political commitment. So the story of the rape did not fit under those themes. Now, the theme of the second memoir, Mexican Hooker Number One, is healing from PTSD in regards to the living in the chronic state of terror when I was in the resistance. So when I started writing the book, that's what I was going to talk about, and then the artistic journey that followed being in the resistance. But then as I was writing it, I realized that it would also make sense to include the story of the rape because it really is a fascinating story, not just because of the rape itself, but because two of my closest friends in my life are also victims of the paper bag rapist. The fact that I have been going to his parole hearings every 2 years, culminating in meeting him face to face for 5 hours. I find those to be really interesting stories. Yeah.
Did you prepare your son at all for the publishing of this book?
No, I did not discuss it at all with him. And so he saw the whole thing was on the cover of the Vancouver Sun for the weekend newspaper in April when the book was about to come out. He saw it, and he didn't quite understand what was happening because on the cover it said, It was quoting the rapist, right? Put your hands on your head, turn around, don't look back. So he thinks, all he knows is that there was a man who was mean to me when I was small. And he thinks that it's Pinochet. Like, he thinks all the bad people in the world are, oh, it's Pinochet.
Yeah.
And I like that he's very innocent, so I want to keep him as innocent as possible for as long as possible. Yeah.
How do you anticipate dealing with that conversation, or do you think that you'll ever have to?
Oh, yeah, no, I'll tell him about it when he's a bit older, for sure. He's a very innocent guy, but he's also not, I took him to Chile 18 months ago when we went on a tour of a concentration camp that my stepfather was in. So he knows about things that happen in this world, right? We went to the cemetery, the general cemetery in Santiago, and left flowers. We spent the entire day there, right? For Allende, for Victor Jara, for all the disappeared, for Miguel Enriquez, et cetera, et cetera. So he understands, yeah.
It's interesting to understand evil through a child's eyes and seeing that evil must obviously be Pinochet, because in the context of him knowing you as his mother, that's where most evil comes from, which almost is a little bit of poetic justice for the memory of Pinochet.
It's true.
Anyways, how about the rest of your family? You mentioned earlier that in writing memoir, you have to be delicate in the way that you handle your story in relation to the stories of the people who were inevitably there. So how have they reacted to the book?
Well, they're very, very supportive. I mean, the great thing about my parents is that they've always been supportive of me following my calling. My father didn't read the first book until very recently because I told him not to, because I thought it would really hurt him, not because he's even mentioned in it, but because of what I describe in the book. And I really doubt that he'll read the second one. But it's always just about, I make sure that I'm self-deprecating in both the books and that I don't make other people look bad.
So you've done a lot of press about Mexican Hooker number one. How have you found the experience of speaking so frequently and so explicitly and publicly about the details of that experience?
Well, I mean, I prepared for the interviews months in advance, right? Like months, and I do that with every project, right? So I spend months like writing down every possible question that might come at me and every possible answer that I can give. And because it is something that I am healed from, it's not like I'm reliving it or having some kind of flashback when I'm talking about it, which is why I was able to write the book in the way that I did, right? I did not write the book for personal catharsis. I wrote it for universal experience. And I think that's why a lot of people have been able to relate to it. It's as exhausting as talking about anything else, really. It doesn't take an emotional toll on me because I have healed from it.
So you're able to separate yourself from the memory of the experience.
Yeah, I feel neutral about it now. And what I feel towards the rapist is compassion. And what I feel towards, you know, the girl that I was when that happened is compassion. Yeah.
Can you talk about your decision to weave the story and the details of the rape into the book the way that you did?
Yeah, I wanted the structure of the book to mirror the actual experience of healing from that rape, right? So I say at the very beginning, like the very first chapter of the book, that I have a flashback when I'm in a voice class at Studio 58. I go back and forth in time, and I keep referring to the rape as like a satellite that's circling my life until one day it just crashes into me. So I wanted the structure of the book to mirror that, you know, life goes on and then once in a while, oh, there it is. So you're reading the book, reading about whatever, right? Like, oh, being a student at Studio 58, and then all of a sudden there's a section about the rape. And then you're back to something else, and then all of a sudden there's another section about the rape. And so by the end of the book, the puzzle has been put together, right? You get the whole story of what happened on that day as opposed to all at once. And also I wanted it to mirror because it is the spine of the book, the fact that I would go to the parole hearings every 2 years, right? So again, also coming back to it intermittently.
I think that decision was particularly effective. I found the experience of reading the book very physical, to be honest, which makes sense based on what you've just said, because as with PTSD, the cause of PTSD sort of flies in and just smacks you in the side of the head when you're least expecting it. So I have memories of turning the page and noticing what was coming next and having to close the book and like wait to be ready to go into that part of your story. Did you have an idea that that would be the impact on some people of your writing?
Yeah, no, I knew that the writing would be impactful in that way. Yeah, and also because the day, you know, the day of the rape is so brutal, right? Like, you know, the rape itself, what happens right afterwards, and the fact that it lasted 3 hours and there was all this psychological torture involved, I don't think that you could get away with doing it all in one go. I think that a reader might turn off, right? And that's one of the things that I explore in the artistic journey part of the book, right, is how do you deal with violence in art without being so shocking that it actually has no effect, like it just makes the reader disengage, or it's just titillating, or it's just traumatizing. I wasn't interested in any of that. Yeah, so I thought that one way to not let it be that was to keep leaving and then coming back to it, and leaving and coming back to it, letting the reader breathe in between. Because one of the mantras that's in the rape part of the book is don't move, don't speak, don't breathe, which is what he kept telling me for those 3 hours, right, when he had the gun to my head. So you don't want the reader to be in that position for the entire book if you just let the whole story go in one go, right?
You've referred to this a little bit already. You write in the book about the House of Pain years. Can you talk about what those years meant to you and how they helped you move forward?
Yeah, the House of Pain years, that was when I allowed myself to have a full-on nervous breakdown and just completely fall apart. And in that, while that was happening, I mean, it was terrifying because you don't know if you're ever going to come out, right? You can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, so it's a terrifying place to go. But I knew there was no getting away from it anymore, mm-hmm. You know, that there was just no getting away from it, that this was it. I just had to let it happen. You know, when I look back on it, I also see a lot of beauty in that time. Like, I was so raw. And the relationships I had to friends, for example, it was raw, right? Like, I let them see me have a complete nervous breakdown, right? Just sob constantly. And you really, really do get to find out who your friends are when you're going through something like that.
Do you feel that that opened up parts of your personality that weren't as prominent in the time before you allowed yourself to just melt into your trauma?
Yeah, I think it allowed me to access more of my softness and my vulnerability. Because for most of my youth and young adult life, I was very tough, right? I had to be because that's what helped me survive. So I honor that toughness, right? But there came a moment when it was no longer useful to me, and it was actually hindering me as a human being. So letting that toughness go and really, really exposing my vulnerable and soft side also allowed my friends to see that part of me.
You write also about the terrified girl who lived inside you and maybe still does. What is your relationship to that little girl now?
Well, I try to be as kind to her as possible, right? To not be so hard on her, right? You know, because a lot of my inner voice in regards to her is, get it together, stand up, get it together, stop it, right? So I try to be very, very gentle with her whenever she comes up.
Do you have like a vision of who she is? Is she actually you as a child, or do you see her as some other embodied spirit or center of emotion?
Well, I mean, I see the 13-year-old me, the one that was raped, and then I also have like a very strong visual for like the 8-year-old me.
And why is that age significant?
Because when I was 8, that was in the thralls of exile. You know, my family was exiled here, and exile is very different than immigration, right? Immigration is all about reinventing yourself in the new land, and exile is all about the triumphant return. And my parents were very, very young, right? They were in their 20s. They were in their late 20s, early 30s. You know, when I was 8, my mother was 27, for example. To be a small child and see your parents go through so much suffering since you were 5 years old does something to you. And they're not capable of fully parenting because they are in so much trauma themselves. So, so I have a strong visual for me when I was 8 because that was in the thick of exile.
Relating to the trauma of your experience in the Chilean resistance as well as the trauma of being raped, do you feel that you've fully recovered from both at this point, or are you still in process?
Oh, no, I think I'm still in process. Like, I mean, I've done a lot of recovery. I mean, I think I say this in the book. You never get over childhood rape. You just learn how to integrate it. So the way that I see all those traumas affecting me now is not obvious. It's not like I don't walk around feeling afraid or anything like that. I feel like I'm always in my body. I'm not dissociating. But it's how I deal with intimacy that is still very terrifying to me. And I know that it's directly related to that, to those experiences, right? Mm-hmm. To still having a bit of a shell around me in very emotionally intimate situations.
On the subject of intimacy, you refer to meeting the man who raped you as meeting a man who you'd been in a relationship with for your entire life. And forgive me if that's not the direct quote. Do you feel you still have a relationship with him, even after processing your story enough to talk about it publicly?
Yeah, I think that I will always have a relationship with him. He doesn't have as much power over me anymore. And it's truly really only in the intimate scenarios that I go, oh, okay, this has to do with that, which is what I mean about being in a relationship with him. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. The other day I was having dinner with one of the other victims who's a very, very, very close friend of mine. And we were talking about that and how it's almost like at this point, it's just like a nuisance, right? Like it's not even like, oh my God, this is so traumatizing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was just talking about being in an intimate situation and something reminding her of it, but it wasn't triggering some horrible emotion in her. It was just like, oh, for God's sake, here it is again, right? Yeah, so that I guess that's what that's where it's at now, is that it's almost like a nuisance. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you feel compassion when you think about him. Do you only feel compassion, or is there a range of things that come up when he pops into your head?
No, I only feel compassion. Yeah, I've never felt angry at him. I've never hated him. I just when I think about doing what he did to children, like if I think about myself doing anything even remotely like that to hundreds of children, I can't wrap my head around it. So I just go, the level of pain and suffering that human being must be in to have done that is, I can only feel compassion for, really.
In Something Fierce, you write about the terror of living and working in the Chilean resistance. In Mexican Hooker Number 1, you write about PTSD more specifically. How do those traumas intersect for you, or do you find that they are very separate?
No, I think that they do intersect. I mean, terror is terror, right? Terror is terror. Obviously, when I was raped, you know, because it was at gunpoint, because he psychologically tortured us for 3 hours, because he did tell us all the ways he was going to kill us, that was incredibly terrifying. But living in a state of chronic terror due to state terrorism is more terrifying, right? And being aware night and day for years that if you do get picked up by the secret police, quote-unquote, just going to rape you and torture you, right? They're going to, quote-unquote, rape you and torture you to get information out of you, and you're going to be giving people away. And also the things that you're going to witness, right, being done to other people was more daunting, I think, than the rape. And also that because I was always very good at compartmentalizing, I always just put the rape in a corner and, you know, locked it up and threw away the key so I didn't have to deal with it. But I think that, you know, they both had the same effect on my psyche and on my body, right? which is completely to completely shut me down and to be completely dissociated and to have huge issues with intimacy.
It's interesting that you say that the state terror is worse when it's something that only tortured you psychologically because you were never caught. So it's almost as though you're imagining of the potential for harm to your physical self and to other people's bodies is worse than actually experiencing that. Can you respond to that difference?
Yeah, I think that what we imagine is probably worse, right, in our brains, right? Like, I'm not afraid of being raped anymore because I know I can handle it. I know a lot of people, women who have never been raped, who that is their number one terror, right? That is the thing that they're most terrified of when they have to walk alone at night, for example. I'm not afraid of it at all, right? I'm not, obviously, would not want it to ever happen again, but I know that I can survive it. It's like, okay, I was able to survive it when I was a child. I would be able to survive it again. The things that I know about what was done to Chilean resistance members, because there are so many of them who are close to me, have told me about it, and I have seen it on their bodies and in their eyes, to me is worse. Yeah, it is.
On the topic of something fierce, you talk in the book about growing up between Chile, Argentina, and in Vancouver as a refugee, but Chile always feeling like your true home. What is your relationship to Chile like now?
It's a difficult one, right? Because I left when I was 5 and then I gave my life to it throughout my youth. But, you know, I mean, whenever I land there, it's home. First of all, just being surrounded by people that look like you physically. The Chilean accent is very particular. To me, it's just the most beautiful sound. Everything. I mean, walking the streets of Santiago. It was interesting. I was there 18 months ago, and I did actually, there was a public reading, a staged reading of my play, The Refugee Hotel, in translation at the Museum of Memory and Human Rights in Santiago. And then I did my own one-woman show in Spanish as well. And it was very strange, I mean, because in Chile, I'm considered a returnee, which is what the exiles are referred to. And so we are outsiders in Chile, right? Especially if you were exiled in North America or in Western Europe. People in Chile literally have no clue what we suffered. They believe that we arrived here and that money grew on trees and that we live in a mansion, et cetera, right? They have no idea what it is to suffer systemic racism in this country, to be what it is to be poor in this country, which is obviously very different than what it's like to be poor in Chile, which is in Chile you live in a shanty town and you literally have nothing. But that poverty does exist here and what it is to be poor in this society. And it's something you cannot talk about with a Chilean as a returnee because they will just shut you down, right? So it's something that you keep to yourself and you talk about with other returnees when you're there. It was interesting because when I was there 18 months ago, of course, I saw a lot of my relatives, and there's only one cousin who actually wanted to talk about it. He started weeping, and he just said, I want you to know that I am a victim of exile because I lost all of you guys. And he actually got it. He really, really wanted to know what it was to be in exile in Canada. Everybody else is just like, shut up. We don't want to hear about it. So I am an outsider there as well. But I am able to fool people like strangers. And that's the best, right? Mm-hmm. When I'm like just walking around Santiago and going to the markets and going into the restaurants and talking to people, they would never know. And that's when I feel most at home.
Anonymously. That's interesting. Besides the cousin who was open about his compassion for your experience, what kind of reaction did you find that people had to the play?
Oh, well, they were blown away. I mean, like, the actors of the play, all of them have never left Chile. I think they finally understood what it is to be in the state of exile, which is that you don't actually want to be in exile. You just want to go back, right? And then when I did my play, I did Blue Box, and part of that play is about me being in the underground in Chile, and it was like, that was a bit of an out-of-body experience, like, am I safe even doing this here? Oh my God, this is terrible, right? But okay, here we go. One of the people that saw my play was an actor who had been in the refugee hotel the night before, and she was very, very moved because she said to me, my father was in the underground during the dictatorship, and he refuses to talk about it. And she said, I can't even imagine what he went through, right? Yeah, I think, I mean, there's real fear because torture still exists in Chile. It's very much present. The people who are tortured now are indigenous people and students. For example, this cousin of mine who was weeping with me, he was tortured when he was 14 during the dictatorship. He was part of the student movement against Pinochet, and he was tortured. He's never told anybody officially, you know, right? Like, he's not on any official list of people who, he's never told a doctor. He's never, you know, there's many people like that. So my point being is that the last documented case of a 16-year-old in Chile was 1 month ago. Somebody like me, the powers that be are not interested in picking me up because I pose no threat at all. I'm not part of the Mapuche movement, and I'm not part of the student movement, right? I'm just, oh God, you know, there's an old returnee talking about, you know, the 80s, who cares about her, right? But the point is that there is torture in Chile still.
That was Carmen Aguirre reflecting on her most recent memoir, Mexican Hooker No. 1 and Other Roles Since the Revolution. Recently, Carmen's play, The Refugee Hotel, was produced at Studio 58 in Vancouver, and if you're interested in her other works, you can find more information at carmenaguirre.ca. Thanks again to Carmen for sharing her story and for being so generous in our interview.
Have a way of promising things.
In today's political landscape, more fires are raging out of control than ever before. Will you help put these fires out by registering to vote in BC's 2017 general election? You can vote in advance, mail in your vote, vote on the day of election, May 9th, or at any district electoral office. For more information about the process or to see where you can vote, visit elections.bc.ca.
Before I sign off today, I wanted to talk a little bit about an event that's happening this weekend, Sunday, April 23rd, at the Astoria. It's going to be a Record Store Day after party put on by CJSF 90.1 FM out of Burnaby and CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine. It's a big collaborative event, and it's going to be a Record Store Day after party featuring performances by Co-op, Jerk Jails, Sad Photography, Alyssa Thorne, and Pale Red. It's going to be $5 to get in, and we will have vendors from all kinds of local labels and record stores from around the Lower Mainland. They're selling merch and records by local bands. It's going to be a really good time. Hopefully people can make it out. We will also be live broadcasting the event on CITR 101.9 FM and on CITR.ca. So come check it out. Come hang out with us at the Astoria for your Record Store Day hangover, and spend some more of that hard-earned cash on some local art. Leave things off here with a song by Co-op. This is Golden Hand. Take care, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Again, this is Shoes on a Wire. You can follow me on Twitter at mjeanetaylor, and you can find podcasts for this show at citr.ca.
doing? This is Sean from Youth Brigade. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Hi, this is Chris Connolly from the band
Hot Panda.
Sorry about that. This is Chris Connolly from the band
Hot Panda.
No, not again.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 Vancouver.